I'm tired. It's Wednesday, January 22nd, a beautiful day in the neighborhood, except on the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. For me, it was a late, late night. And for those of you who also stayed awake to watch the impeachment hearings, I finally just drifted off at 10 after 12 and I went, oh no, I fell asleep. And then I woke up at like 1 o'clock and I kept watching the television. I'm like, oh, please, God. I mean, if I need my sleep, imagine the people that are arguing this case. Mm. Imagining the House managers. It's just it's remarkable. And I'm having a mind fart. Who is basically leading the House managers?
Adam Schiff.
So this morning we're gonna grab him really quickly, Bill Curry. And I realized as I was listening to Adam Schiff just did an amazing job.
He's
beyond gifted, and he does it without notes, and his level of outrage and memory and facts and passion and yet somber and stable, he's just compelling. So I said to Bill Curry when I sent him a note asking him to come on this morning, I said, Bill, if I could come back, I want to come back as a combination of Ambassador Hill and Adam Schiff. They have everything I want. Everything. Watching both of them and their commanding performance and their commitment to country, the level of patriotism and knowledge and understanding, and they're just – those two people represent the best of public service. The best of public service. I want Profiles in Courage to give those two people a joint award, not like the New York Times punt, but because they represent sort of the two aspects. One is the one that serves as the ambassador and the other one that gets elected and still is able to maintain such an incredible level of integrity.
But for Hill to be in the diplomatic service and know that really her career
is
tied to whoever is the president, and even, frankly, presidents who are not in the same political party.
Right.
No employer wants someone who is a complainer who might embarrass them in public sometime later if they should do something wrong.
Right.
And she just took the ball and ran with it. She said, I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. And you know me, that's my expression. I think that there are so many times in this country, both politically and otherwise, when you can tell the difference between right and wrong, and you just should, everybody should, in my view, do the right thing. I'm not Spike Lee, but really, we need to do the right thing. And Fiona Hill and Vindman and all of those other people just said,
just amazing.
I don't care about what happens to my career, but this is the right thing to do.
And
I'm not going to let this happen.
Adam Schiff was just, I think, just remarkable last night. So I just want people to know, I saw when I watched Adam Schiff, that's when I wanted to be in Congress. I never really regretted too much losing in 1996. But then watching Adam Schiff today, last night, I regretted not being there. I wanted to be part of that speaking truth to power. I wanted to be able to run those risks. My resume, I've had so many jobs over the course of my life, and I won't tell you how many times I have been fired because I wouldn't play the game. And it's just littered, and I've been blacklisted. I've been blacklisted, everyone. You have no idea. So I get it. I get the risk, but this is a high-profile risk. I mean, nobody really knew because I was in this tiny little bubble getting fired from a little job. These people are doing it on a world stage, and they're taking amazing risks, not just with their future, but with their lives.
Well, I think Schiff, if you had asked me at the beginning, as you usually do, what do you want to talk about today? Adam Schiff is what I would have said because he was really masterful. He summarized the allegations, the facts, the timeline, and put things in perspective in language that all of us could understand.
Right, in the vernacular.
You know, I've watched so many hours and hours of hearings and testimony and everything where it's all just sort of a mishmash.
Yeah.
And he just put it out there like, okay, this is what's happened. And this is this happened the day after that happened. And the things we heard came out in the news, you know, months apart. But now he's got this timeline where this thing happened the day before Trump's phone call to Zelensky. And it's like, oh, now I see what's going on. It's not a one-off phone call. It's like this pattern from early spring through September or whatever.
Remember when Ross Perot did those informational ads when he was running for president?
Look under the hood.
But he spent a lot of time showing us graphs and charts. As I'm listening to Adam Schiff last night, what I wanted to do was do a clip of Donald Trump's attorneys basically lying, okay, mm-hmm. saying this is not, and then right after that have Adam Schiff's response and run a 3-minute ad. So you always have the integrity of both sides, mm-hmm. okay? I want you to hear what the president is saying, okay? I want you to hear what the House is saying. And then you decide. Because after you hear it, how do you not take a shower? How do you not say, this is wrong? I would wash my kid's mouth out with soap. I would send them to their room. This cannot be what the president is doing. But always give their side first and then have Adam respond and just do a 3-minute ad and just do it over and over again. Because if I were a suburban housewife, I would suddenly because that's what we keep looking for on the Republican side. Those suburban housewives get it because they want to raise their children well.
Right. You know? They want to raise their children to do the right thing.
Right.
And as a lawyer myself, I just could not believe that these Republican lawyers were lying.
Lying.
Oh, bald-facedly
how
lying.
How did they not get disbarred?
You know what? That's exactly it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, as a lawyer, my whole career for 40-plus years, I was so cautious to make sure that what I told or represented to the court was accurate and not even close to the line.
Right.
And these guys just step a mile over the line and don't even flinch. It's remarkable.
And what was that statement about the fact that he keeps his word or he means what he says? One of the attorneys said that last night. And I'm thinking, which word?
Yeah.
Misogynist, liar, coward, abusive. I mean, what word? He's never kept his word on anything to anyone. To anyone. Ask his former wives. You know, I mean, let alone the bankers who he had to deal with, let alone the people he never paid, let alone the staff that's run away from him because they can't even rely on him because they're afraid to say anything because he'll undermine them the next hour. Oh,
right.
My God. To say that after 16,000 lies is just shocking. Let's go to Bill
Curry.
I'm
going to call Bill Curry.
Okay, everyone. So I called Bill and I sent him a note and I said, Bill Curry, well, you need to come on. And it was so cute. Because he sent me an email and I had not yet sent him the topics that I sort of wanted to talk about. And before I was able to sort of connect with him, he says the following. So you want to do Hillary, Warren and Bernie, or just straight impeachment? And I wrote him a note and I went, well, I've already sent you topics in the mail, but no surprise, we're on the same page. And if you look at the attitudes page, you will see our conversation for today with Bill Curry. And as we're grabbing him, let me introduce him, even though he's not on the line yet. And that is that Bill Curry was a former advisor to Bill Clinton. Bill Curry ran for the governor of Connecticut twice. He won the primary but did not win the general election. He has been an activist his whole life. He's a commentator. He writes for Salon.com. Everyone I know after hearing him says he's probably one of the most thoughtful, inspirational, hopeful, even as he's giving us the medicine, the sort of tough news, but really someone that we turn to on a probably maybe even too often basis because we need to hear his voice and we need to sort of process his analysis as we look at a time of tremendous chaos. And, I mean, it's chaos because of the late nights now with impeachment. It's chaos because in New Hampshire we're about to enter the New Hampshire primary. And I will tell you right now, too many of us are wickedly undecided. It's not even a question of electability because we don't know what that means in the time of Trump. But we're trying to figure out who will both beat Trump but provide us with a policy agenda and a leadership agenda that will address the precariousness of the times. I keep talking about the urgency of the moment. We are living in a time that just seems more precarious than almost any time in history. And it's not just because of global warming, and it's not just because of the growing gap between rich and poor, and it's not because of what's happened as a result of social media and our inability to figure out what to trust. There's just to be this sort of cacophony of chaos out there. And then on top of all of that, we have to look at what's happening on the planet. And the planet is in some kind of interesting meltdown. All right. So joining us right now by phone, I've already introduced you, Bill Curry, is William Curry. He is joining us today to talk about – actually, you can choose it. Do you want to start with Hillary first? Do you want to talk about last night's impeachment, the opening night of impeachment? I don't know how late you stayed. I fell asleep at 12:15 and then I was so ticked off. Or you want to talk about what's going on with Bernie and Warren or Bernie and Biden? I mean, it is – we have too many riches on our plate and all of them feel a little toxic, Bill.
They do all seem a little toxic.
They do.
If you want to do impeachment first, why don't we just, I don't know how much I have to say about it, having watched a fair amount of it yesterday. Mm-hmm. The Democrats have routinely underperformed in committee settings for the last 2 years, whether it was the Kavanaugh hearing or the Mueller hearing or the impeachment hearings. And I thought yesterday they did better.
They did do better.
And I thought that it was probably because almost everything that they had to say were read from prepared remarks that staff had no doubt worked on very hard. And so sticking to that text, to their texts, I think they did really well. They showed that at least their entire apparatus, when it's all employed, can construct a public argument. Mm-hmm. This has been a major question mark for me about the Democratic Party for a long time. And this much was clear: when the entire apparatus of the Democratic House caucus is brought to bear on a public policy question, it is still capable of delivering. Delivering a clear analysis and message. So I thought that was good. I don't know what that means. I was watching Michael Moore on TV. I taped it, and I watched a little bit more this morning. I think it was Seth Meyers.
Okay, I missed it. Go on.
And he was talking, and Michael Moore was insisting, somewhat improbably, that he still believes that the Senate may convict. And I would just say this, it all comes down to the witnesses. I've said on the show before that
the witnesses.
I think we should have subpoenaed every one of those witnesses. I think that every hearing should have been open, from beginning to end. The House has closed door hearings all the time, especially in the Intelligence Committee, but people don't know that. It was easy to caricature it.
Yes, exactly.
They should have bent over backwards to make it transparent. I wish we had more articles of impeachment. In a sense, I get that the pollsters thought it was better to narrow this just to Ukraine because they thought that was more understandable and more discreet, and the time was of the essence. And those are all arguable claims. I think that just by limiting it in that way, we've left off the table that Trump is monstrously corrupt and dishonest, and that the 16,000 lies he's told in and of themselves are such a profound subversion of democracy, and his corruption of his entire branch of government that he presides over is so deep and wide that we should have found there were ways in which we could have included that. Having said that, where we stand right now, if I had a piece of advice to give them, it would only be this, that we all know that Bolton, Pompeo, and Mulvaney's testimony can settle this. If they were to honestly testify before
this... But Mitch McConnell knows that too.
Yes, of course he does, but we're not saying it to him.
No, I capisce.
And we're trying to build pressure, and I just wish people would be a little more disciplined in repeating those points. We have to be as masterful and persistent in telling the truth as they are in lying.
Yes,
and the truth of this is the simple truth of this situation is that those guys can settle this, and now they may come and perjure themselves. They may come and honestly report things that I don't expect them to report. But the great likelihood is that there are three eyewitnesses out there who can settle all these claims and counterclaims, and emphasizing that this testimony is not just something to which we have an abstract right as a people, or to which the Congress has an abstract right as an institution, but that these are the witnesses who were there.
Yes.
These are the eyewitnesses, and the reason we want them to testify is probably the same as the reason that the Republicans don't want them to testify, which is that they can settle this.
Yeah. But go on, Ken.
But, Bill, the key is if they tell the truth. And what I makes understand. You confident that they won't lie or at least spin things.
I mean, we saw the lawyers yesterday lie. I mean, let's be honest here. These lawyers should be – we were just talking before you came on the air that a lot of those lawyers were saying things that were patently false, patently false. Adam Schiff was very polite about calling them liars, but they were liars. And I'm thinking, are they – why aren't they disbarred?
I don't get it. You know, Roberts at the end of the day admonished both sides, the House managers and the Trump lawyers, for lack of decorum. And even, you know, Chris Coons, centrist Democratic senator from Delaware, said that he was right to admonish both sides, who seemed to have forgotten that they were talking to the world's greatest deliberative body.
Yeah.
Chris thought the New Hampshire House of Representatives was listening in.
Yeah, exactly. Oh no, it was.
But the real question about the court that mattered is not just, you know, whether they were sufficiently civil, but whether they were telling the truth.
Exactly.
And the Republicans were lying ceaselessly.
It was incredible.
And all provable lies, all demonstrable on a record already established. It would be nice if the Chief Justice saw the distinction, and the Democrats have to call it out. And I would say even more sharply than Schiff did. I'd agree with you.
Yeah, no. Well, so let me just say something. Adam Schiff was the only one who really was off script. No, and I don't mean off script in that he wasn't right about what he did, but he was the only one who was really extemporizing. Exactly.
Yep.
So he was tasked with after Trump's lawyer spoke, he would then do the response, and therefore the response could not be scripted because you had to basically respond to the in that moment. And I have to admit, I thought he was pretty brilliant. And the one thing he was not only brilliant about was in describing the new young untested president of Ukraine and making people understand he did what he had to do, you know, that of course he was never going to say that Trump was trying to shake him down. How could he say this? I mean, he framed it in such a way that was both human and understandable, and you understood that what he was saying, the Ukrainian president, was what he needed to say to protect his country and wasn't necessarily the truth because of how powerful Donald Trump was. You know, and I just thought that there was a way of telling a story, and I thought he told it incredibly well, Bill.
I thought he did very well. I wasn't rhapsodizing quite as much as you are,
awesome.
But I thought he did a very good job. And he was the one Democrat who was again extemporizing and responding in the moment to Republican arguments. And I thought he did very well in that.
Yeah.
And I just wish we were a little better at making the overall. This was an entire day, as we've spent an entire month now on process,
right.
And not the process of Trump's crimes,
right.
But on the process by which the Congress will consider them, and that the Republicans have really set it up in such a way with both the House and the Senate that argument over institutional process in itself becomes a cloak over Trump's crimes.
Exactly, exactly.
And it breaks my heart, and so emphasizing the simple fact of this, Pompeo knows what happened. These are Trump's own appointees. They are his highest level appointees, literally Secretary of State, Chief of Staff at NSC.
That are still employed.
His three highest level appointees are the only eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. You claim it's all circumstantial evidence, and you block the testimony of the eyewitnesses. We can settle this. And I know that it's somewhat of a you're taking somewhat of a chance to say that, but it's really I think it's true, and I think the likelihood is that under penalty of perjury, they would say enough of the truth. That I think it would be I think it's just, you know, for Trump, his tax returns and business records, he's gone. Sworn testimony from his three top officials,
he's gone.
Yeah. And in that way, Michael Moore is correct. If those things happened, I do believe that this would become untenable for the Republican Party. And so we should almost talk about nothing else.
All right, now I'm going to make you talk about something else. So let's talk about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
It's great to have her back, isn't it?
It's just so I want to make sure everyone heard her tweet last night, just in case you missed it. And the tweet last night was, "I thought everyone wanted me to be authentic. unvarnished views. But to be serious, the number one priority for our country and world is retiring Trump. And as always, as I always have, I will do whatever I can to support our nominee. This is after she trashed Bernie and said that Bernie had no friends. And basically when she was
asked, would you
endorse him, she didn't answer. And I'm thinking, do we really want her to be authentic? I'm just trying to
She made it very clear over multiple occasions that she was not willing to commit to support the nominee of the Democratic Party,
right,
which is simply a continuation of, you know, her long. I made the mistake of reading her memoir of the campaign, which really just left me feeling so sad. There isn't a single moment in it in which she takes real responsibility for her own errors. Yeah. She was in that campaign a victim of the Electoral College, of James Comey, of Putin. It's all true. And she, you know, the election was rigged against her by all those forces. At the same time, it's also true that she abandoned the DNA of her party, the progressive New Deal economic populist strains that had made this party work. She paid no attention to the corruption of government. And Trump was able to steal those themes and run them against the Democrat in the industrial Midwest. And that's where he stole the election. It would be nice if she tweeted someday that she took some responsibility for that. You know, it wasn't her failure to visit Wisconsin. It was her failure to run on the traditions and values of her own party.
And that's the debate that's going on now within the Democratic Party about who should be the nominee, right?
And that is the fight. So I was talking to a reporter from NPR last night, and of course the question is it, should we get a moderate or a progressive? What is the message that will win? Do we want to convince the suburban housewives, enough of them that voted for Trump, that you really want us because we will not upset the apple cart and go back to whatever normal was that wasn't so good? Or do we want to look ahead as the progressives are talking about and begin to say, look, you know, I don't want to go back to the status quo because the status quo gave us the biggest gap between rich and poor, because the status quo added and abated climate change, because we can't survive the status quo, Bill.
All respect to Bill Clinton and to Barack Obama, I truly believe that their refusal to commit to ethics and other political and governmental reforms and their fundamental conscious abandonment of the New Deal, the DLC, that the Democratic Leadership Council that Clinton helped found, their stated purpose was to overturn the influence of FDR in the party.
Yes.
It's what in the beginning they told everybody they were doing. Later they became a little more sensitive on the point. But it, the idea that the Democratic Party should in critical juncture, most critical juncture in our nation's history, not examine its own mistakes, not acknowledge these errors, and put itself back on the right path. That's, you know, if you read the Times and the Post, you know, what they all seem to be saying is, you know, for God's sakes, this is no time to be questioning what Obama did. Well, if those mistakes are what brought us Trump, and in large part I believe they are, then with all due respect, we have to debate them.
Yeah.
We have to debate them. And as I said in the last show, at the same time, there are mistakes that progressives have made. And, you know, we shouldn't be in a fiscal bidding war. We don't need to be in a cultural issues bidding war. We have plenty of issues that we've wanted to see action on all of our lives. And we can bring this thing home now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we ought to be working out those differences within this party and coming up with a platform that we can believe in and run on.
So I posted on Facebook this morning. I wrote, starting with the election of new Democrat Bill Clinton, the Democratic Party became a handmaiden for Wall Street, for big money, for big pharma, for criminal justice reform that meant incarceration, even as it enhanced the root causes that made it impossible to succeed. Sadly, as we played on the wrong side, the campaign finance laws and the growing gap between rich and poor made it easier and easier to abandon working folk and the poor. We lost our soul.
And amen. And again, we keep getting into this, you know, and I was deeply disappointed in Warren, the same charge that the Hillary people made in 2016 about Bernie bros. Mm. This was stuff that was so unfair and undocumented and so persistent. Sanders worked so hard for Clinton. And I can tell you as a progressive, something you know, mm-hmm. and that is that it's the progressives in every election who, after we lose the primary, put the winner's bumper sticker on our car and mm-hmm. soldier on.
Yeah.
And it's the party establishment types who give money to the Republican when the progressive wins.
Or and, stay home and don't vote.
That's the real history. It's mm-hmm. you know of what's going wrong here. And the question about 2016 is not the at most 300,000 or 400,000 Sanders voters who went to Jill Stein, but the 9 million Obama voters who went to Trump. The discussion should be how to get them back.
Well, and as I pointed out the other day, and I've been saying this over and over again, the reason why we have to use Michigan as a really interesting storyline is that while Hillary Clinton never really visited Michigan, lost Michigan by under 11,000 votes, it isn't the Jill Stein voters that I want. It isn't even the Barack Obama that went to Donald Trump voters I want to know about. I want to know why nearly 80,000 voters showed up in the voting booth in Michigan and didn't vote for either Trump or Hillary.
Yeah.
80,000. 80,000, that's double the number.
Heart.
Oh, it break because we got them in there. They knew that voting was important. They wanted to exercise the franchise, but they looked at the top of the ticket and they couldn't even choose. What does that say about her inability to resonate with voters in a way that said, I hear you, I see you, I'm going to change it for you?
Oh, I thought from the beginning of the race of 2016 that she was the only Democrat that Trump could defeat. And the reason for opposing her in the primaries, a reason for opposing her in the primaries, was the very reason that she was advancing on her own behalf, which is electability.
Yeah.
Democrats bought the idea that the centrist celebrity must be the more electable. And it wasn't true. The center that they had carved out wasn't the real center of the American people, not even close.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I just look at this and I want to avoid some of the same thing. I think Hillary also, by the way, Hillary left a lot, for all of her complaints about her treatment by Bernie, Hillary left a lot of bad taste in the mouths of Bernie supporters from the way the election was conducted, from canceling all the debates so right. that no one would ever get a look at them
right.
as anti-democratic. There were, I won't go through the whole litany, but there were right. a lot of them, but mostly through their attitude toward him. And they decided that they were going to use a kind of elitist identity politics to describe him, to conflate him with Trump, that populism, Hillary despises populism, and despises the base that espouses it. It was June of her own election year before she even endorsed a raise in the minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah.
That was her weakness. And that attitude left a lot of people turned off. You know, it's the job of the nominee to pull the party together.
And I need to let you go, but I want to remind you that there was a poll that came out about a week ago, and not looking at South Carolina, but looking at the African-American vote across the United States, the two candidates that come number one and number two with African-American voters, it turns out it's Biden and Bernie.
Yep.
And Bernie. So as we look at what's going on in South Carolina, understand that African-American voters exist in 50 states. And you have to start looking.
And it's partly, by the way, because the very reason that Bernie offered in 2016, when explaining why they weren't for him, he said, I'm not that familiar to them. And now he is, and
yes,
polls
exactly.
quite well.
Exactly. Yes. To know Bernie is not necessarily to hate him, Hillary Clinton. And on that note, ciao, Bill Curry. Thank you so much. I appreciate
Talk
it.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1849. That was the birthday of U.S. labor leader Terence Powderly. Powderly was born the second youngest of 12 children to Irish immigrants in Carbondale, Pennsylvania. At the age of 14, he went to work for the Delaware and Hudson Railroad. In 1871, he joined the International Union of Machinists and Blacksmiths. Also involved in local politics, he was elected mayor of Scranton, Pennsylvania 7 years later. Powderly is most well known for his leadership of the Knights of Labor. The Knights of Labor were a new kind of U.S. labor union in the late 1880s. They invited workers to join regardless of their trade or skill. They helped to lead the fight for the 8-hour day. In his autobiography, Powderly described why he was so committed to the labor movement, writing, 5 men in the country controlled the chief interests of 500,000 working men and can at any moment take the means of livelihood from 2.5 million souls. The goal of the Knights of Labor was to give voice to those 500,000 souls. By 1879, Powderly rose to become the Grand Master Workman, the highest leader of the Knights. Powderly was weary of strikes as a tactic for labor. Yet, despite these personal qualms, the Knights led several successful strikes under his leadership, including one against railroad tycoon Jay Gould. The Knights grew to represent 700,000 workers across the nation. But then, the Haymarket tragedy occurred when a bomb was thrown by an unknown assailant at a workers' rally in Chicago in 1886. In the aftermath of Haymarket, there was a national backlash against labor unions. The Knights bore the brunt as membership dropped by nearly 90%. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The town of Blacksburg, Virginia, is working to cut 80% of its carbon pollution by 2050, and it's making progress by promoting residential solar and transitioning to cleaner buses and government vehicles. But staying on track can be tough. Like many other towns, local officials must juggle competing priorities and work with limited time and money.
It sounds ridiculous to say potholes always win over climate, but potholes always win over climate. Always.
That's Blacksburg Sustainability Manager Carol Davis. She says that making steady progress is especially hard when cities and towns feel like they're on their own.
We need leadership at the federal and state levels. We critically need it. And so what I'm really working at the state level is collaborating with my colleagues and identifying concrete legislative priorities.
For example, she wants to see Virginia revise its energy policies to allow community-owned and operated solar projects. She says these changes could make it easier for towns like Blacksburg to pursue climate goals, while also managing the day-to-day upkeep of water mains, sidewalks, and those potholes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Each year it gets harder to let your mind roam from the carnage abroad to the wreckage at home. Too many folks falling, ashamed and alone. It gets harder each year to ask why. In a land of good people, why the men at the top are so goddamn crooked, they got to screw on their socks. Was it 12 years ago we elected that guy who could look into the camera and lie?
Look into the camera and lie. I wonder who he's talking about, but it doesn't matter because, unfortunately, it's been too consistent. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Producer Ken Barnes picks our music. So who sings the song, Look Into the Camera and Lie?
That's Charlie King.
Wow.
And I just couldn't resist.
Oh, phenomenal.
Given seeing those Republican managers last night looking into the camera, looking at the Chief Justice of the United States. Just and, lying.
Oh, my God. It was just amazing. Just amazing. And so let me set this up. I was looking at the New York Times, and a couple of my friends sent me this opinion piece. And it was entitled, How the Health Insurance Industry and I Invented the Choice Talking Point. It was always misleading. Now Democrats are repeating it. So I read it, and I went, oh, this is great. Then I read it again, and I went, oh, God, this is terrific. And then I actually reached out to the author of the opinion piece and said, can I read your whole damn article out loud on the radio? And guess what? On Friday, I did exactly that. And now This is even better. I get the writer of the article on the air with me. Wendell Potter is an author and strategic communications consultant, but this is the nugget that you have to pay attention to. A former health insurance executive, Wendell left his job as head of communications for one of the nation's largest health insurers after a crisis of conscience. Yippee. And as a result, Wendell, you have become the voice for truth. The voice to call out the lies of the insurance industry, the ability to inform us about how we're being manipulated with how they package and market their for-profit product called insurance. And now you are also very active in the Medicare for All campaign. And you posted on a tweet, I think it was yesterday or this morning, and I actually followed up on it. And I wrote the following. As we obsess about impeachment, about Zephyr attacking Biden, about Hillary attacking Sanders, about Trump embarrassing himself at Davos, this happened. And it was, major changes are needed, declares the 159,000-member American College of Physicians, to a system that costs too much, leaves too many behind, and delivers too little. And what did they do? They endorsed Medicare for All. Congratulations, Wendell Potter. I think you were part of this conversion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So, Wendell, share a little bit about the crisis of conscience, because I want that piece for people to hear as we talk about what you really know about how we've been sold this story of insurance. And as I've said to my friends and folks, I want a billboard that says, health insurance is not healthcare. Repeat, health insurance is not healthcare. But you know they conflated the two.
Oh, absolutely. And most people kind of think that that is true. But of course it's not. Health insurance is supposed to be your facilitator to get the care that you need, but all too often it's the barrier, the roadblock to getting the care that you need, just because of the way that our healthcare system has evolved. And I did have a crisis of conscience, as I've often called it. I came to realize that what I was doing for a living was helping to perpetuate a very dysfunctional healthcare system, one that was very profitable for the companies that I worked for, but was becoming increasingly unattainable for a lot of folks, too expensive. And as I noted earlier, instead of facilitating access to care, in too many cases, insurance companies will say no. They do that in various ways, through their limited networks, reducing choice of healthcare provider, making us pay a lot of money out of our own pocket before our coverage will kick in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a system that really we just need to really put on the ash heap of history and move to a Medicare for All type of system that will be much more efficient, much fairer, and everyone would be covered.
Well, you know, I and the idea that doctors weren't necessarily plugged into what was happening, but now with each passing year, they're becoming more and more aware of the challenges to healthcare, which I think explains what just happened with that most recent endorsement, that they suddenly realize that it isn't just about their paycheck or the specialist that, you know, makes, you know, six figures or seven figures, that now it really is, why did you become a doctor?
And
you didn't become a doctor. And I'm going to share a little vignette, and then I want you to get into your article. And I've told this story before, and you will understand it having worked for Cigna. And that was that when I was running for governor, I discovered a lump in my breast. And I called my husband up, and I said, I think I need a mammogram. And my husband said, you can't get one. I went, what? He said, I had a choice, pay the property taxes or pay the health insurance. And it was at the time of the economic downturn in New Hampshire. And he said, people would know if I didn't pay the property taxes. They wouldn't care whether I paid the health insurance or not. So he dropped our health insurance. So I didn't go into the doctor until we were able to get reinsured. And when I went into the doctor and he said to me, when did you feel the lump? I told him a couple of months ago. And he said to me, well, then why did you wait? I said, because we didn't have access to health insurance. And he said, oh, Arnie, we had a sliding scale. You could have afforded a mammogram. And here was my answer. I couldn't afford the answer. Because if I didn't have health insurance, I'd have a pre-existing condition and my family could never get covered again. And you had to see the face of the nurse and the doctor. It was like I gave them a knuckle sandwich. This was 1993. The problem is that problem has become more and more. I mean, yes, we've gotten rid of maybe, you know, the pre-existing condition, sort of. You know, the idea of now allowing your children to stay on your health insurance policy till they're 26. But understand that story in 1993 should have been a story that was told to every physician and every doctor and everyone in the world, because that's the story of what health insurance was making us do, making us make Sophie's Choice.
You're so right. In fact, 1993 was the year that I actually started working for Cigna. And at that time, I was a believer in managed care and felt that it was an appropriate way for us to manage access to health care and manage costs. But I came to realize over the years that I was there that that was not the case at all.
Yeah.
And as you know, back then, insurance companies could also refuse to sell you coverage because of a pre-existing condition.
Exactly.
They would blackball people or charge them a lot more if they were willing to sell them coverage, and in many cases, far more than people could afford.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's get into your piece, because the most important part of the headline in the New York Times isn't how the health insurance invented the choice talking point. I think the most important thing was it was misleading, but now, this is the part, listen to these words, Democrats are repeating it. So let's talk about this fiction called choice, because I think it is a fiction, and it breaks my heart that the fight that we are now seeing between the progressive and the moderate is now coming up on the idea of choice. And you and I both know that when I hear the word choice, what do I think about? I think about abortion. So the word choice for me as a progressive is, oh, yes, I want choice. Oh, yes, I want choice. But when it comes to this choice, it's a brilliant word, but it's so deceiving.
It is. It's very deceiving. And it's one that insurance companies know and their PR people know resonates in a positive way with most Americans. And they use that to confuse people, to make people think that they actually do have choice when they don't. Very few people in this country have really a choice of health insurance company. Most of us who are insured in the private market, we get it through our employers, and it is our employer who makes that choice. We don't have a say in that. And you know, the employer also decides which health plans we have access to. And the choice that really, really matters to Americans is the choice of health care provider, not insurance company. We want to make sure that we have access to and we'll get coverage for care that's provided by a doctor we want to see or a hospital we want to use.
Yep.
That's what I was trying to help people understand, how my old industry and people like me have been able to manipulate us and our thoughts to get us to think things that just simply are not true, so that they can benefit, so that they can continue to profiteer.
Okay, so let's talk about the fight that we're seeing now between the sort of the Bidens and the Mayor Pete's and the Bernies and the Elizabeths. And I want you to sort of comment a little bit about the Medicare for All, because you support that. I support it. I've been a Medicare for All baby for a long time. And yet what I see is that the choice that they are saying is we still need to maintain the private insurance industry, and we're going to make it more attractive to, like, go into, you know, some version of some sort of public option or some sort of version of Medicare for All who want it. Tell me how you listen to those fights and how Wendell Potter processes. Because my understanding is when you look around the world, when Canada embraced their single-payer concept, they didn't do it as a switch. They did it province by province by province, and then eventually they embraced their healthcare solution. So tell me, how do I distinguish between what Bernie and Warren are suggesting and what the more moderate version is? Is it truly about choice, or is it about something else?
It's about something else. It's not about choice. Although the moderates are, again, falling into the trap of using the language that the insurance industry wants them to use. The problem by just adding a public option or letting people enroll in Medicare if they want to, that enables the insurance industry to continue to operate the way they have always been operating. And because we have a multi-payer system, that requires us to spend so much more on healthcare than any other country in the world. And that's because when you have multiple insurance companies, they spend enormous sums of money on administration and overhead. They demand profits. They spend enormous sums of money on marketing and sales, and lobbying and paying people like I used to be. About a third of what we spend in this country, and which is about $3.6 trillion a year on health care, about a third of that goes to overhead. It doesn't have anything to do with us getting the care that we need. So that's what we need to eliminate. And when you just add one more option and keep the private insurance industry in place, you're not going to be able to reduce costs and assure that everyone gets the care that they need. And you'll continue to the insurance industry will maintain all of the practices that they've and procedures that they put in place that, as I said earlier, they have erected barriers to care. They're not facilitators. They are barriers to care.
Right. And let me also say something else. The reason I am sort of offended by no Medicare for all that wanted or expanding the public option is that once again, government is stepping into the place where they're taking care of the sickest, the oldest, the poorest, the whatever. And we're leaving the insurance industry with the healthiest, the most profitable, and they still get to direct the terms of choice. So I want people to, I mean, think about this. When you look at Medicare and Medicaid, what do they represent? It was a gift to private insurance. It was a gift to them because we said, we'll take the poor people. You don't have to worry about them. We'll take the old people. You don't have to worry about them. We'll leave you the young people who don't get sick. I mean, just think about this. Yeah. And then if you add this expanded public option or this Medicare for all that want it, they get even the healthier people because guess what? The only people that will be choosing the Medicare for all who want it or the public option will be those who find out that the insurance industry will be driving up costs for them. So they're going to want to go into the public process, which means we are paying more and more. And the whole concept of insurance is having healthy people in the system with old people, having young people in the system with sick people. And yet what the insurance industry wants is they don't want any of those. They just want those that they can make a profit off of.
Yes, you're absolutely right. They have devised many, many ways over the years to cherry pick the customers they want.
Exactly.
And for those who really need care, if they're enrolled in a private plan, they have many, many ways of making it difficult for us to get the care that we need.
So, Wendell, here's my big question. And that is, you saw this sort of interesting fight between Bernie and Elizabeth. And I feel like, you know, it's really a choice, but it's not a choice. So Bernie talks a lot about Medicare for all, and he creates the impression that, you know, when he becomes president, we're going to do it. You know, there's not going to be a transition. We're going to do it. Elizabeth is a little more nuanced. She's going to figure out how to pay for it. She's going to figure out maybe a transition. It'll take us 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. So I want to have a come to Jesus moment with you, Wendell. Let's talk real. You and I both know that healthcare, given the enormity of the size, given the amount of people you have to transition, it is not a switch. I don't believe that you can shut off the current system and turn on a new system without some kind of segue to the new system. So, Wendell, you've been studying this for a year. You were inside Cigna. You know this topic. You've talked to doctors about it. Tell me how we get from where we are today to Medicare for all. What is the more honest answer? And I don't want to – and obviously the idea of choice is a distraction. I want to know more about how the path is to get there.
You're exactly right, and it is nuanced, by the way. The difference between Warren's approach and Sanders' approach is not as significant as the media has made it out to be.
Thank you.
Even the bill that Senator Sanders introduced and the lead author of, and as he said, I wrote the damn bill, even his bill has a 4-year transition to Medicare for all.
No, I know. Go on. Keep going.
Yeah, exactly. So it does take time. You're exactly right, and it gives people the opportunity, you know, the time to become accustomed and for that transition to take place. The legislation that is in the House has a 2-year transition, and whether or not that's overly aggressive, I guess, would remain to be seen. But, of course, when the legislation is actually working its way through Congress, there will be changes to it. But even in the most optimistic transition, it would be at least 2 years, and under the Sanders bill, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind, when the Medicare program was established, there was a very rapid transition, people were able to enroll in that pretty readily. And it's very different this time, too, because when the Affordable Care Act was passed and the exchanges were set up, it was incredibly complex situation or undertaking to establish all the exchanges, and every state had a different mix of health care insurers. So it was incredibly complicated. It wouldn't be that complicated to move everyone to a system that already exists and has been around for 50 years.
But also let's remember that when we passed Medicare under Johnson, I mean, these are people that did not have health care. So you were not fighting the insurance industry. You weren't fighting big pharma. Nobody was losing their job. In fact, people were getting coverage and living longer. I mean, so in a way, the simplicity of it and the opportunity of it can't be replicated today, because now what we know is, and you pointed out the lobbying and the money and the this and the that, what does big pharma do? They buy and sell their politicians. What does, you know, big insurance do? They buy and sell their politicians. And it's not only the issue of choice that's now coming out of the mouths of Democrats, the lie the insurance industry perfected. But now the other question is it, how do we transition recognizing how many people are employed in that lie? How many people are working for insurance companies? Yeah. How many people are working for big pharma? How many people? And as we transition, those people have something on the line, too. It's called their livelihood.
It's true. They have the livelihood. And one thing that is in both the bills in the House and the Senate, for those who would be facing their jobs going away because they wouldn't be necessary, there's billions of dollars that are set aside in the legislation to retrain them, to help them find other jobs. A lot of those jobs, by the way, will not go away. Insurance companies have diversified a lot over the years. I used to handle the communications around mergers and acquisitions, and I can tell you that all of these big companies have profit centers that don't have anything to do with selling insurance and covering people.
Right.
So they, for one thing, they will not go away. There are people whose jobs are, as I said before, are standing in between us and our doctors, and and those positions are the ones that are not necessary, wouldn't be necessary in a Medicare for All type of system. But a lot of those folks who hold those jobs are doctors and nurses.
Right.
The insurance companies employ tens of thousands of nurses that are already skilled and trained and used to provide care to patients directly, and they can return to being caregivers instead
And think of the number of people now that will be covered, and the people that aren't making decisions because they can't afford the deductible, or they lose their job and they can't afford the COBRA. I mean, people don't understand. There will be so many jobs created because everybody gets coverage, and you don't lose the rural hospital because the big corporate hospital has bought out the rural hospital, and nobody can go to the rural hospital because why? Because they're so poor they don't have access to insurance, or they're on Medicaid and it doesn't pay enough to keep the rural hospital open. I mean, when you begin to look at what's lost. And the other thing that I was thinking about, Wendell, is that, you know, if I would love to go in front of those people that are afraid of losing their job and ask them whether they believe in climate change. And I bet you all of them would raise their hand and say yes. So do you think that we should continue to mine coal? No, of course not. Do you think we should continue to frack? Oh, of course not. So we need to shut down those industries, right? Of course.
Yeah.
What do we do with those people? And in a way, it's the same conversation with them. This is kind of like insurance change as much as climate change. And insurance change is really where we need to go. And if we understand the choices we need to make for climate change, then I'm going to ask the people in the insurance and big pharma industry that we have to make changes too, because it is about our well-being.
It's about our well-being. And those who are concerned about potential job loss in the insurance industry, you know, I care about everyone's job.
Me too.
I have a job, but I also want my, you know, my relatives and my children to be able to get the access to care and get the care that they need. But to me, that's what is ultimately important and the most important thing here. We can take care of those people whose jobs will change or be eliminated. That's in the legislation. We'll take care of those folks.
Exactly.
Can I ask a quick question? You're a marketing expert, so why is it that people are fooled by this choice lie? Why don't they recognize every year when I was covered, I would worry that my employer would get a different health insurance plan or a health insurance plan with worse conditions, you know, deductibles, high deductibles, and worry if my meds would cost a fortune next year, if they'd even be covered. I mean, everybody goes through this every year.
Why are they seduced?
And exactly. And then, you know, people change employers or have no job.
Or they have job lock and they're afraid to change their employer.
So they go from one employer deciding for them which insurance is available and go to another. You know, why are people fooled by this? Or better yet, why can't the Democrats or the progressives make an argument that this choice is just not true.
And some are, to their credit, but most are not. And they're again, as we said at the early part of the conversation, they're using the talking points and the framing that the insurance industry and its allies want them to use. And right. So are a lot of journalists as well.
Yeah.
What's going on is there's an acronym called FUD, and it stands for Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt. And the messaging, the PR campaigns that the insurance industry wages, and I know this because I used to do them, and I hate to admit that, but it's true. They are designed to obscure truth and to get people to believe things that are not true and to instill fear, uncertainty, and doubt in people's minds. And they're very successful. We in this country, not just in this country, but people are loss averse. They don't want to
right.
think that they might lose
they're
something.
They're risk averse, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And people have been led to believe that what would replace what they have might not be as valuable.
And right? Wendell, I need to let you go. Write your next opinion piece at the New York Times about FUD. No, I'm serious. Write about FUD, because guess what? It'll become my next talking point, and it'll become the talking point of other politicians on the campaign trail, so they can say, I understand why you think you like choice, but let's understand what you're really not being given, you know, which is healthcare.
Yeah.
Wendell Potter, author of Strategic Communications Consultant, but the best part, a former health insurance executive who left his job as head of communications for one of the nation's largest health insurers after a crisis of conscience. I'm so glad you have a conscience. Join us again, Mr. Potter.
Thank you, Arnie. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Care. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes, and we end with?
We end with Give Me Some Truth by John Lennon. I picked that out thinking we were talking about, again, the impeachment trial and the Republicans
we
lying
need
in our
from
face.
Insurance.
But in the insurers also, it's the same point.
Here we
Give
go.
Me some truth.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things.